very clear through the foundations of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, having come out of the Rio Summit, which looks at environment and development. Developed countries have accepted their responsibility for causing the bulk of climate change and accepted the responsibility for needing to take the lead first and fast in doing something about it. Now, if they're not doing that, then clearly negotiations will remain stalled.
It is one of the greatest political conjuring tricks ever performed on the general public. It is the fatal flaw at the heart of both the EU and US climate policies, which threatens to make a scientifically robust and fair climate deal in Copenhagen impossible. It is the reason that when the EU says it is cutting greenhouse gases by 20% by 2020, or 30% if there is a global deal in Copenhagen, they are in fact putting a cut of just 10 or 15% onto the negotiating table. It is also the reason why, when the UK says it is cutting greenhouse gases by 80% by 2050, it is actually committing itself to a cut of only 40% within the UK. This week on the 300 to 350 show, we take a look at the creative accounting mechanism which makes this sleight of hand possible. Carbon offsetting under the United Nations Clean Development Mechanism, more commonly known as the CDM. The CDM allows rich nations to buy up credits that have been generated by projects in poor countries, which are supposed to deliver both sustainable development and cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. Since this is a market-based, profit-driven mechanism, it is not in fact delivering sustainable development, and it is not delivering additional greenhouse gas emissions cuts, referred to as additionality, because many of these cuts would have happened anyway. And yet, rich countries are counting so many of these largely fake carbon reduction credits towards their domestic targets that it allows them to justify new investments in high carbon infrastructure, such as new coal-fired power stations and ever-increasing airport capacity. This delusional approach means that rather than rapidly decarbonising their economies, they are making runaway dangerous climate change inevitable. Shortly after the publication of the most accessible summary of the case against carbon offsetting under the CDM, a paper entitled A Dangerous Distraction, published by Friends of the Earth back in June, I had the opportunity to put the report's key findings to the European Commissioner in charge of the EU's emissions trading scheme, Yvonne Slingenberg. The Friends of the Earth report concludes that carbon offsetting under the CDM is profoundly unjust, fundamentally flawed, and cannot be reformed. It must be scrapped. Here's the interview I conducted with Yvonne at Green Week in Brussels, and a follow-up interview a few days ago with one of the report's authors, Tom Picken, who is also head of the International Climate Team at Friends of the Earth. Yeah, there's four main criticisms that they're levelling, and they're saying at the end of the day that it can't be reformed, this offsetting CDM has to be scrapped. Mm-hmm. So the first one is that actually the science says that we actually need cuts in both the developed and developing countries, mm-hmm. substantial cuts now. 40% cuts in rich world, and 30% deviation from business as usual in the developing world. And offsetting kind of upsets that balance and doesn't allow that to happen.
Well, it's true that then what needs to be done in developing countries would, of course, need to go beyond the offsetting. And that's exactly what we are also discussing in the international negotiations. Not that that's my direct responsibility, but
the thing is then that putting the onus on developing world more than
exactly. I mean, that is one. That is the EU position that, you know, part of the emission reductions that will have to be done in developing countries will need to be on their own account, and those could then not count as offsets. And that is why we do want to move away from the CDM as it is today, while stressing that we think it has had a very important role, because it has really put CO2 emission reductions on the agenda in developing countries, you know, and it has brought it into their development agenda. I think that we can fairly say. So we do really see it as a very important capacity building instrument. It has taken off quite impressively. I mean, when it was put forward in the negotiations in Kyoto, I think, you know, everybody was very had a big question mark around whether this would ever work. But it has triggered the interest.
You
say you're
moving away from it. Are you?
Well,
you said,
friends of the earth.
You're not on the verge of scrapping it.
It should be scrapped. No, what Joseph Vega said in the panel is that, you know, we would envisage a role still for the Clean Development Mechanism with a better procedures, better checking of additionality, financial additionality, environmental integrity for least developed countries. Because they're really, they have so few emissions. There is no sense in talking about this going below business as usual emission growth for them. That would really not make the difference at the global level. So when we say 15 to 30% below business as usual growth in developing countries, it should really be targeting the big emerging economies, and that's what we say. So not only China, you know, India are the obvious ones, but certainly also, like somebody said, for the time being, even South Korea is still considered, you know, in that UN context, a developing country. So that cannot continue.
EcoEquity, for example, has done an analysis saying that if you wanted to continue the trading, the kind of CDM facilitation of developing world cuts, then actually rich countries should be setting themselves a target of like 80% by 2020, mm-hmm. rather than 40%.
No, I do agree, but I mean, we basically, you know, this is not just in the hands of the Commission. We always have to see what is feasible with the member states, what can be agreed, what the European Parliament supports. So,
and what,
of course,
and what industry will find acceptable?
Well, yeah, of course, industry will tell their governments, you know, what they think is acceptable and all that. But I mean, I think we are in this dilemma between the science, you know, and what politically is feasible for the time being. Mm. But that's where there is this interesting dynamic where the EU says, okay, we will do this on our own anyway, irrespective of what everybody else does, and we are prepared to go further. So, of course, you know, that is in a way a little bit of a catch-22, but it should hopefully become a race to the top where everybody says, okay, I can do more, if you do more, etc., etc.
Several studies have concluded that a lot of these CDM projects would have actually happened anyway.
That is
all
also
these hydroelectric
dams
in China.
Yes, we are very concerned about those criticisms, and we have in fact taken that up in the sense that on the one hand, in the international negotiations, we very strongly push for reform, for better checks on additionality, what is really, you know, something, a project that would not have happened otherwise, and the hydro dams are a strong concern in that context, but not only the hydro dams, there are, you know, other industrial improvement technologies which have economic benefit on their own and wouldn't need CDM, let's say, financial support. But we have, therefore, in our new provisions within the EU legislation, made an option for the EU to ban certain credits. Because if we can't get these things agreed at UN level, we want to be able to make sure that if there is doubt about a certain type of project, that we can say, well, we no longer accept that kind of emission reduction in our system.
But what seems to be happening is, on our quotes, the study by Wara and Victor from Stanford University, there's strong pressure from CDM investors to limit the kind of administration costs, mm-hmm. and speed up approval. So
exactly.
There's strong lobbying for the checks and balances to be weakened, and they're already insufficient.
Yes.
So it's only going to get worse.
No.
The EU always rolls over to corporate pressure. That's the history.
Well,
look at what happened in the EU climate and energy package.
Well, I think the package has not been weakened very much.
It was weakened substantially, and there's widespread criticism about that back in during Poznan.
On the offsets, that's correct. But I mean, and that is a weak point, but we have the provisions in there that can tighten that. What I wanted to say, you brought me off track a little bit, is that, yeah, what we mentioned before, the EU also wants to limit transaction costs and administrative burden and all that, but in another way, not by weakening the requirements of the CDM. On the contrary, we want to tighten those. But what we are saying is that for the non-least developed countries, or the emerging economies, we want another system, a new mechanism, which we call a sectoral crediting mechanism, whereby you can have very tight procedures in place, but they would then, once agreed, apply to a whole sector. And then the business has the clarity, okay, if we invest in this sector, and the example we always give is the power sector in China, you know your procedures, you go through them once, and then every investment you do in improving CO2 emissions from the power sector in that country will not have to go through the same procedures. So that would really substantially alleviate transaction costs. So there are other ways of doing that. It's true that there is this push, but I mean, we think we can combine that by saying, look, developing countries should do part of their action on their own, because any such investment in a sectoral crediting mechanism would also be beyond the baseline. So we would set an already a certain improvement that developing countries should enforce on their own, and anything that goes beyond that could be financed through the private sector and the generation of credits.
By continually rolling over to the corporate agenda, the EU is actually doing itself a disservice by delaying the transition to a low-carbon economy, making it more expensive, more difficult to achieve, and locking in high carbon infrastructure. The UK is saying we can continue to build coal because we'll buy some offsets.
But I suppose
we'll continue to expand aviation. We'll buy some offsets.
Yeah, which is maybe not the right way to go. But
and the pace is similarly undermined throughout the EU.
But I do suppose you hear on your channels also people who say, well, it doesn't matter where you reduce emissions, as long as it happens somewhere in the globe, that's okay for the climate. Now that is not necessarily our view. I'm saying on the contrary, you know, from the side of DG Environment and the European Commission. We say, you know, it is very important to look at the longer-term perspective, and we need to trigger that technological change. And that is why we have put in place a legally binding limit on offsets. Okay, up to half, which is a lot, you know, which is a lot. But there is the trade-off between what do you do in terms of investment in other countries where they cannot pay for it, you know, themselves. They will
there are other proposals on
the
table to raise finance for countries.
Exactly, but you know how difficult
it is to raise G77 in China. G77 in China, that's public finance. The Norwegian proposal, which could be scaled up, is...
I would like to see, you know, how that Norwegian proposal will move on in the negotiations. Yeah. I personally don't think it has all that many chances, because it would mean an upfront commitment to, you know, vast amounts of money, which would be good, but let's see whether governments will sign up to that. No, but I think we cannot ignore the private sector involvement in all this. They have the potential to really also trigger finance, but also a mental change. You know, if people start understanding that when you make an investment in business in a developing country, you should take into account the CO2 cost, and the lower you go in terms of CO2 emissions, the better it will be for your, you know, future competitiveness. That is what we need. That is what we need. So we don't want to completely abandon the notion of, you know, investments in developing countries or offsets, whatever you want to call it, but we want to tighten it substantially, make it much more, you know, move beyond a certain business as usual or economically viable options for investment anyway, because as somebody said, I mean, the most efficient plants these days are often not in Europe or in the US, but in the developing countries. So this is normal investment behavior anyway, and if you want to move beyond that, you have
The downside of the lowest cost, the downside of the lowest cost argument, which is the argument, the main argument that is used, is that you get all these externalities. Seeking out the lowest cost doesn't seek out things that have social and environmental benefits necessarily, the best in social and environmental
agree.
Benefits.
I do agree. So these elements
and,
are very important.
And it's been shown very clearly that that even though the CDM was set up with two objectives, sustainable development and climate change mitigation, it's not fulfilling its sustainable development objective at all.
No, but I think you will see that, you know, that's exactly why the carbon market and the CDM investors are not so pleased with the Commission and the EU as a whole, because we have put limits, and we have put this provision that we can limit credits when there is doubt on their environmental integrity and social implications. And I think that is, you know, is really important. They're very displeased, so, you know, there is always a balance to be struck. I hope I gave you a bit of the arguments on both sides.
Probably what we were trying to build in terms of these radio shows was a sense that there was a consensus, particularly from the kind of developing countries and the NGOs, that on the one hand you've got an urgent scientific message saying that you need quite dramatic cuts, and also in order to get a deal you need a sense of fairness, and yet Yvonne seems to be openly admitting that it's the EU policy to shift the responsibility of making emissions reductions from the EU and other rich countries to the poor developing countries. That's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
It is very extraordinary when offsetting is defended by those states and the corporations who are massively benefiting from a system which enables them to carry on business as usual, and put that burden of responsibility for making those emissions reductions to poorer countries who have vastly smaller per capita emissions. It's not a surprising response. I think there's a sense of complacency in EU and Annex One country policymakers more generally that this is the orthodoxy of climate change mitigation policy. It's quite astounding the level of acceptance of a mechanism which is so clearly and so has been so well documented as being a failed mechanism.
So for rich countries to try and incorporate these kind of levels of offsets into their policies, and we're seeing the US do a similar thing in the cap and trade bill that's going through Congress. I mean, what is that going to do to the possibility of reaching a scientifically robust and fair deal at Copenhagen? How are the majority world going to respond to this?
Well, two things in your question there, science and the response of the majority world. Well, on the science, it's quite clear. I mean, some analysis I've seen about the US legislation going through Congress at the moment means there wouldn't have to be any domestic action in the US until, you know, 2025, 2030, this kind of time frame, really delaying any serious infrastructural change. Looking at the EU, we've got now for the period 2013 to 2018 through the third phase of the EU ETS, looking at a level of offsetting enable, which will be more than half of emissions to be offset. Now, these developed countries, the EU and the US, according to the best science, to have a good chance of avoiding dangerous climate change, and I'm not talking about a 50-50% chance, I'm talking about a good chance of avoiding dangerous climate change, the EU and the US have to collectively achieve greater than 40% emissions reductions by 2020. Now, already the levels of cuts on the negotiating table are well below that. We know the EU's committed to 20, said they will go to 30 in the context of a good international deal. The US is still talking about going back to 0%, 1990 levels by 2020. Already, you can see the problem there. If those developed countries then also delay and offset those emissions reductions, failing to make real emissions reductions, we're further moving away from a target which is already completely inadequate. There is a complete divorce of reality between the target setting in the EU and the US and other Annex 1 developed countries and what the science demands. Now, that's not even going into the issues of justice and equity, and I think your second part of your question around how does the developing world respond to this. Well, we see that the response is rightly, well, if you're not going to do anything, then why should we? Now, that is a dilemma and the gridlock that we have to get out of in the international climate negotiations. It's very clear through the foundations of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, having come out of the Rio Summit, which looks at environment and development, developed countries have accepted their responsibility for causing the bulk of climate change and accepted the responsibility for needing to take the lead first and fast in doing something about it. Now, if they're not doing that, then clearly negotiations will remain stalled.
On the second point, many studies have shown that emissions reductions promised by offsets are in fact illusory. Many of these projects would have happened anyway. Yvonne actually acknowledged that that was a concern, but she said the EU is pushing strongly for better checks on CDM projects. Do you know what checks they're proposing, if they'll get adopted, and if there'll be enough to ensure that the CDM delivers real additional carbon reductions?
The reforms on the table for the CDM are all in one direction, and they are all in the direction of streamlining the supply of offset credits. The reforms are not regulatory reforms, they are reforms to ensure the more rapid supply of offset credits through much bigger mechanisms. It is quite a leap, and I've never seen any rationale from proponents of expanding the CDM for how this disconnect is joined. On the one hand, there's a broad and wide acceptance of the failure of the CDM on terms of it being just simply a swap in emissions, so it doesn't add up to the science. It's almost impossible to approve additionality, and it will become more so as policy becomes more aware of climate change in its development in any case. There is no guarantee of those reductions, and not to mention the sustainable development and problems, not seeing any benefits there. Financial transfers are sporadic and too low, and it's a tool for increasing inequality and not addressing justice. So apart from all those things, which are well documented and well acknowledged, policymakers, those proponents for expanding the CDM, say, well, what we'll do, we'll reform it and expand it. Yet there is no sense of how any of those problems will be tackled all we hear is, no, they will just be upscaled into new sectoral offsetting mechanisms, this sectoral crediting. So we're taking the worst out of a small mechanism and we're going to make it much bigger. That seems to be the logic at play.
So you're not convinced by that response at all?
I think we need to have a clear burden of proof to demonstrate how a mechanism has environmental integrity, how it works, how you can prove it works, and how it doesn't increase inequality. I think there's some pretty important criteria there that have simply not been fulfilled in the rationale for expanding offsetting into a sectoral crediting mechanism.
I think it would be useful if you could just say what sectoral crediting was, very briefly.
Sure. Sectoral crediting is the proposed expansion or reform of the CDM. So at the moment, the Clean Development Mechanism is a project-based mechanism. It is about a particular project in a particular geographical location in the developing world, and they are financed through the Clean Development Mechanism by those countries with a responsibility under the Kyoto Protocol to make emissions reductions. Now, from the current form of it being a project, the proposals for a sectoral crediting mechanism are to shift that into sector-wide economic activity, so whether you're talking about a particular industrial process or a particular type of energy generation, those sorts of things across an entire sector would then qualify through new rules which would have to be created to then enable the supply of a much greater level of credits into the market. So we're moving from a small project-based mechanism into a large sectoral across-the-board mechanism. That is the proposals on the table.
Okay. The third main point from the dangerous distraction was that it delays the changes that we need to make by having all these offsets in the system. For example, The Guardian recently reported that there were around 50 new coal-fired power stations being planned in Europe, which is obviously going to commit us to emitting large amounts of CO2 for decades to come. Yvonne didn't really seem to have any useful comeback to this at all, but is arguing that without offsets, you won't get funding for cuts in least developed countries. What do you say about that?
Well, the two aspects there are, one, is it causing delay in the north? And very clearly and very simply, yes, it is. And, however, is the justification that it's providing money to the developing world a good enough reason? No, it's not. On the first, the delay to action in the north is horrendous. I mean, we're getting into the realms of the absurd when we're looking at decisions, for instance, in the UK of expanding Heathrow Airport for a third runway. Looking at the projected emissions just from the expanded airport emissions in 2050, the annual emissions from just the airport are greater than the entire UK carbon budget in 2050, according to government official targets. It is simply absurd that we can get to a point where we are justifying the expansion of carbon-intensive infrastructure because those emissions will be dealt with through offsetting. And that was very clearly stated by the UK Transport Minister at the time, that the justification for the decision on Heathrow Airport was that we can offset those emissions. Clearly, we're in fantasy land there. What we need to do is stop building carbon-intensive infrastructure, and we need to do that now to avoid dangerous climate tipping points. There is no other way around it. What we need to do in addition is support the global clean, sustainable development in developing countries, so countries who are rapidly industrializing can leapfrog this dirty development path. There is no way around it. We can't do one or the other. We have to do both. We need to recognize as being historically the major contributors to climate change and having much higher per capita emissions today and having the better capacity, financial resources to deal with climate change, we have obligations, legal and moral, to financially support the clean development in developing countries. It's not a case of doing one or the other. We have to do both.
Okay, one thing that was coming across from not just Yvonne, but statements from EU officials right throughout Green Week, so it seems to be a common position emerging from the EU, was that their responsibility is only to the least developed countries, and that emerging economies or non-least developed countries should therefore pay for their own emissions cuts up to a certain baseline improvement. Is that a shocking failure to acknowledge and live up to the historical responsibility, or is there something in that?
It is shocking. What we can't have is Annex 1 countries picking and choosing who they support. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is clearly premised that there are developed countries and there are developing countries. Of course, there are differences in developing countries,
but we still have dramatically inequitable situation of per capita emissions between developed and developing countries. That division exists for a reason. It encompasses historical development, it encompasses historical wealth and historical responsibility for emissions. It's becoming a situation where developed countries thinking that it's acceptable simply to support the very, very poorest countries, and that then somehow relieves their obligation for the wider international community, is not an acceptable position to take. Buying off the least developed countries to relieve pressure on their own responsibilities is not acceptable.
Okay, I mean, we don't know really how much of this is negotiating posture and how much movement the EU is likely to give, I guess. We've got the Bonn informals coming up starting on the 10th of August. What needs to happen there, do you think, to move this forward?
The negotiations currently are rather deadlocked. There is a heavy expectation from Annex 1 countries that developing countries need to take on commitments. They're expecting them to do so without having come forward with their legal and moral responsibility of providing finance for clean, sustainable development and for adaptation, and without having made scientifically informed, adequate commitments. That's not getting us to a point where we can progress negotiations. Ivo de Boer, the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, described after the last negotiating session that Annex 1 countries are essentially asking developing countries to jump out of the plane and telling them that, don't worry, we'll give you a parachute on the way down. Now, I think that's quite a good illustration of the problem that we face. We need to see on the table the firm financial commitments and Annex 1 countries taking responsibility for announcing scientifically informed and equity informed targets which can help us avoid dangerous climate change. So what we hope from here, moving through to the next couple of negotiating sessions, is that we see some real progress from developed countries on their financial commitments and their own emissions reductions commitments.
That was Tom Picken, head of the International Climate Change Team at Friends of the Earth, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, and lead author on the A Dangerous Distraction Report. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. For links and references relating to this week's programme or to hear the show again, please visit the Climate Radio archive at climateradio.org. We're playing out with Robin Williamson's Political Lies. Thanks for listening.
Political lies, political promises, the shadow everywhere, a sense of powerlessness. You and I left, basking in the anguish of those we have failed to heal. In the night I listen to my own darkness. I think being born and dying of the same jacks and aces. I think about the signature of God on the prison and about following signs and becoming lost again. Political lies, political promises, this shadow everywhere, a sense of powerlessness. You and I left with the same old question, the sheer unspeakable strangeness of being here.